the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Today is Thursday, February 20th, 2003. We are continuing public hearings on House Bill 5054, the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and House Bill 5055, the Fee Bill for the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Ms. McGlashan, would you like to kind of give us an overview? It seems to me when we left off yesterday, we had given a bunch of research questions to the commission.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, that's exactly correct. There are quite a number of requests for information to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and they've come back with a packet of information for you, and my understanding is they're going to continue with their budget presentation. If you turn to the PowerPoint slides that are in the back of your presentation document, the one with the blue cover on the back, and turn to page 4, the first slide on that page is links to Oregon benchmarks, and that's where they'll be starting from their presentation and weave in the information that you requested yesterday as it pertains to the individual slides they're going to go through. But they've also got some information that doesn't really correlate with some of these slides, and I think they're planning on presenting that first and getting that out of the way, and then moving on with the rest of the presentation.
We might also note for the committee members that the subcommittee has been canceled next week. So I would urge you to leave that block of time uncommitted, but this sub will not meet next week. Let's go ahead then. I better officially open the public hearing on House Bill 5054 and 5055. And Ms. Chamberlain and Ms. Evenson-Brady and Ms. Ames, please proceed with the information that you brought in to us and your presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair. And as we discussed, I want to respond to the issues that I can't tidily weave into our budget presentation and then use the rest of it for the rest of our budget presentation. So the packet in front of you has a yellow piece of paper that has everything in it that we could collect for documentation. The first thing that I would note is the multicolored clip packet is a copy of our agendas for the last year. I know that the chair in particular was interested in what we do for 2 days. It's really a day and two-thirds most often. The structure of the meetings is very straightforward. We have three committees that focus around our three statutory duties: the disciplinary committee, the licensure committee, and the program approval committee. So, for example, at our next meeting, the program approval committee will spend at least 3 hours hearing from a university on the East Coast who wants to offer a licensure program here in Oregon.
Oh.
And so there's like 2 4-inch volumes of materials they put together to show us what their program would look like. The program committee will listen to their presentation, quiz them, point out to them where they feel that they haven't met their burden of proving to them that they know what the program's going to be, and they'll most likely have to come back for another meeting. Then it goes to the commission for full approval. So the discipline committee handles the each of the cases that are ready to be processed at that point in time. And so you'll have a better picture of this probably when we come back to our work session and I get to bring the detailed discipline issues. So at that time, the committee gets the complaints, and if it's a new complaint and the investigator's done an investigation about whether the committee believes we ought to proceed. So every committee action has to be ratified by the full commission. The licensure committee is the committee that handles almost everything you talked about yesterday except for those two issues, the policies, the master's degree issues, and those types of issues, how our license is working, how our rules are working. The big issues, I try to make sure the entire commission has a policy discussion on it, so it's not a third of the commission having the policy discussion. And then in some way, the full commission gets to hear the policy issues. So so that, and it's very similar to this process, I guess, in some ways. The full Ways and Means will never hear all of this detail. They'll hear your report. And the issues that we can do that with, we do. The ones that are the big issues, I like to have the whole commission involved. So to give you an idea. So the other thing that we have to do is we have to spend some time, we also spend our meeting times doing hearings on administrative rules, because we are the hearing board for that. So if there's a change to administrative rules, we conduct the hearings during our meetings. And then finally, we do have to spend some time becoming educated. So this next meeting will be devoted for about the third time entirely to No Child Left Behind, because the commission has a very key role in the highly qualified teacher piece. And we will be cooperating with the Department of Ed on that piece. But what we've had to do is determine how our licensure system fits into the federal high quality teacher requirements. So I hope that gives you some idea of the work that the commission conducts, and that's what's here. Any questions about that?
Questions or comments on the commission meetings?
I just want to point out one thing, just FYI. In a few minutes when we get through our presentation, I'm going to show you some dead slides of our webpage and show you how you could go onto our webpage if you ever wanted to see the supporting documents. We don't just publish our agenda. So the most of the agenda meetings look like this for the commission meetings. Those materials are electronically accessible online, so folks don't have to call us and ask us to send them and those types of things.
Thank you. Let me interject here for the committee members. This is the final day that we have scheduled for teacher standards and practices, and we were wildly successful yesterday in getting them off of their presentation. So I hope that we would consider today that they need to get finished.
Yes, ma'am.
Actually, the rest is fairly short because I can weave a lot of your questions into our presentation. On the light brown or tan document, the school nurses, what I have for you are the standards for school nurses, the statutes for school nurses, and the numbers. We have 97 licensed school nurses, and only 20 of them are employed in the public schools right now. When I said I knew there weren't many, I didn't realize there were that few, frankly, out of the 60,000 licenses that we have. And the school nurse cannot teach. The purpose of the school nurse is to conduct and coordinate the health services programs in a school. It's my understanding, and you have to understand, I had to go back and ask people about the history, that in the 80s that the nurses pushed for these regulations, that they wanted nurses who were working in schools to have to go through the TSPC to get a nurse certification. It's sort of a rule without any teeth, because the rules say, and the statutes pretty much say, that the only thing we can do is issue them a school nurse certificate. We can't. If they meet the qualifications, we don't ask any other questions. And that was at the nurse's request also. They must be a licensed nurse in order to be a school nurse. And the part that makes not quite as much sense to me is that the school district may hire a nurse, not have the nurse certified through the TSPC, but they may not call that nurse a school nurse.
Mm.
So I'm just reporting to you what.
Or is that by your rule?
It's by rule that were promulgated with the assistance of the nurses. So.
Looks like it's an ORS.
Mm-hmm.
The 342-465.
We're getting them off track.
Sorry. Please proceed.
Thank you. The other thing I brought for your information, which I think is better reading than you would imagine, and I know how much paper you folks receive, but on the very back I brought some real recent reports. The first report is a supply and demand report, and what it really does is address head-on the math science shortage, which was an issue that came up. and the whole picture of teacher shortage in Oregon. And it's very enlightening. We really don't have a teacher shortage in Oregon. It is incidental to the regions and having difficulty getting people to move there. And so this is research that was conducted with the university systems. And in the back are tables that give fascinating information related to our teaching force. The other document I brought for you, another recent research study, the attrition and retention study of teachers as of July 2002. Most of these reports were funded with federal grants related to Title II Higher Ed Education Act and other monies, so that you know. And it just talks about the retention and attrition of inexperienced teachers. But the document that really will open your eyes about some of the challenges that schools are facing, particularly in a resource-challenged era, is this one-year after study. So what they did is they took recent Oregon graduates and they went and talked to them 1 year after they had been in the school system and said, okay, how well did your teacher preparation program prepare you for what you encountered? And the whole back page are their direct verbatim comments, and so it hasn't been filtered, and it's actually a little disheartening. Your heart goes out to the challenges that new teachers face in buildings. And then the final report is also interesting. It's a review of administrators and their evaluation of how their preparation programs have prepared them to do their job. They're very candid reports, and they're on the Oregon University System Reports research page. So readily accessible, but I think Representative Bates pointed out yesterday, if you don't know these things exist or where to find them, they're a little difficult. And like I said, you pick them up, and they're fascinatingly easy to read. The rest of the information we brought, I believe we can weave into our budget presentation.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. I'm going to put these out of my way. I'd like to. We left off yesterday with the links, which are in page 19 of your budget notebook, The part that I would like to discuss, I think this is a major accomplishment for TSPC. We had a budget expectation that we do this exercise. Actually, I think it's been expected of every agency, and apparently we haven't been able to do it in the format that everyone else has done. And the second big move that I am wanting to point out is that it had been this agency's position in the past that we were only had secondary links to benchmarks, but I think it's really clear that if good teachers impact learning, that and we play a role in helping schools get good teachers, it makes some sense that this agency would have a primary effect on the benchmarks that measure student learning. So those are benchmarks C, D, and E. Just to cut quickly to the chase, we have done our data research that are on about the third pages. What I wanted to share with you, though, were the areas that I felt that we had some shortcomings in our benchmarks after we'd put them together, ran them through the agency, and connected them to our budget. And I think some of it was pinpointed yesterday in our discussion. We don't have a key performance measure for measuring the quality of teacher education programs. And we struggled with this with the agency. And I think that this is something that will needs to be looked at more keenly. The part that I do not know for sure, to be candid with you, is whether it's my impression that our site review let me back up a second. Every teacher program that's approved is reviewed every 5 years by a site visit, and they have to present documentation that they're meeting their standards. In addition, they have to submit an annual report saying how, if they haven't met a standard, they are attempting to meet that standard or improve that standard. They also are supposed to submit to us every year an evaluation of what their students are saying about how well prepared they feel. But that's the ongoing systemic review. The it's been my impression from the little bit that I've been here that these site teams, which are not higher ed teams, they are teachers and administrators in some higher ed, are actually pretty, they are not, what's the term I want here? They're hard on the institutions is where I'm trying to go here. They really do attempt to review the standards, and they don't let them slip by. And if a institution comes in and believes that it's going to be an easy experience, then they're generally in for it because it's practitioners who are looking at what they do. So I can say that with certainty. However, what I can't do is tell you that we have any solid benchmarks to tell you how they're making that assessment. We do have standards, and I'll get to that when we get to the teacher approval program that we meet, but we have a met and unmet, but we don't have a rubric for how you get to met and unmet. And I think it's just been sort of institutionalized through people who continue to go through and do this and say, oh, okay, here's the top standard in the state, and these folks don't measure up. So I think that's something that we really do need to look at so that somebody can look at.
So were the discussions that you had when you were trying to add that benchmark around how you measure it where you ran into problems?
Yes, a lot of it has to do with me not ever having done this exercise before and not totally understanding when I first did it what I needed to do, and the other part of it was the progress board's overwhelming workload to get all our agency performance burdens done, frankly. And so in talking with Jeff Tryons, we agreed that when I came back, we could have a better stab at it. We just negotiated about, I wanted to say that we would have a 85% or better of standards met for each institution. He thought it was better that we would have an average of all the institutions of standards met. Do you understand what I'm trying to say here? So it was sort of a negotiation thing. That
is the negotiation still going on?
Not technically, unless you say so.
Ms. McGlashan, can you note in the information that we bring back in work session when we talk about benchmarks that we should bring this issue back up again?
Okay. In the meantime, that'll give me some time to look at how we might be able to couch that differently and have it more detailed. I'm not satisfied with that benchmark, frankly. I think it leaves a big gray area in a major area of work that we do. And another benchmark that I'm struggling with, I was trying to capture how do you measure the three buckets of work we do. Our primary work is licensure. And we do have some dead-on performance measures for that and trying to get applications processed quickly when they pay for expedited, getting those done quickly. And then what's related to the licensure, the customer service issues all come up related to licensure. And so we have a customer service we don't have a dead-on customer service measure is what I'm trying to say. It was trying to capture how do you measure that without spending a lot of money on a survey that goes out and asks people if they're satisfied with the service truly. So the measure that we have here, which is under our goal 3, is the number of public service reps, because it's very clear to me our failure to do good service has to do with being short-staffed. So with the volume of phone calls that we receive. So if part of our budget request includes asking for one more public service rep, what our public service reps do is they literally, two of them stay on the phone all day long, every single day, and only two people handle our phone calls, all the telephone calls that come into our office. The third public service rep answers the 15,000 emails that we get with questions and has a turnaround time of 48 hours on those. And we do have a few slip through the cracks, but that's improving. The fourth public service rep would do part phones, part emails. We think that there's... So how I see that working is the two existing public service reps have to wait until there is a lag in order to return the voicemails. So, because the phones do start ringing. And the another public service rep would allow somebody full-time to return voicemail while the other two are answering the phone and the other public service rep is doing email.
Do you track any kind of general categories that calls fall into?
Not yet, but we have talked about that, Representative Morgan. I've talked with Larry back here, who actually, Larry, in addition to being my office manager, runs all the IT in our office. There is software that we can put on our voicemail system that allows our public service reps that when the call is answered, it would go immediately to the licensed person's file and allow us to categorize if they were talking about renewal, it was a new licensure question, it was related to a complaint, and allow them to journal the calls. Right now they journal on a notebook and keep that, but we don't have a system to. We have a contact log. We can tell that someone called in and they contacted us. We get the software that will allow them to put a few lines in right then and improve that.
It seemed that there would be potential for streamlining the way that you can handle them if you can clump them into some kind of groups and do some kind of programmatic responses.
To the extent that we can do that with email, we do. The problem that we have is literally every question is unique. You know, I have this in my master's degree program, or I have this in, I did this in the last 3 years. Will that qualify me for renewal? And it would be a combination of substituting and teaching or volunteer work. And the circumstances are so unique, these people do need personal service. So when people get through and get served, the evidence is very clear they're pleased. It doesn't mean that we don't occasionally tell them something wrong or tell them something different. And I think a lot of that goes to how the question gets asked sometimes. And sometimes staff just makes a mistake, and we have to fix that.
Representative March.
Sorry to interrupt, but as we were talking about the benchmarks, and I was looking over number 5, and it's sort of the lowest denominator of a benchmark, counting.
Yeah.
And if you were going to use a counting one, you'd probably want to count the number of people or educators attending those workshops would be a better count than the number of workshops offered. And on your web one, you'd probably want to count the number of hits if you did a counter on that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's tough to judge building awareness, unless there's some sort of test out there that you're running, or some sort of a feedback mechanism that you have that creates that awareness. Measurement.
Madam Chair and Representative March, this. Let me help you understand some of the struggle and analysis that I had. I think sometimes we believe if people know what the disciplines are, how you discipline, and you discipline less people may be disciplined. I'm not sure that's if A plus B equals C.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I started down that path, I was having trouble getting, say, I think it was setting ourselves up by saying, yes, we'll do these workshops, therefore we'll probably be able to see a drop in the number of disciplines. I think it's closer to where Representative Bates is, that we sort of just scratch the iceberg in terms of what people report, and that it's not relative to anything that we do. That doesn't mean, however, in my opinion, I think where we'll get with the workshops is the rising slope of the curve. In other words, we'll go, if we educate everybody about what they should be reporting, presumably there'd be a peak then of reports, and then it would drop back down on the bell curve. That was sort of my thinking. And so these two were to compel us to get out and do this, and part of it's been a resource issue in terms of ability to. I have 3 professionals in my office, including me. So that would be the folks that would be going out to do this. So by having the benchmark, we would proactively do something on the web, proactively create a web page, a publication, and proactively do workshops. relative to discipline plan. Because then the interrelation is, if there's less confusion, there's less contact with the office to ask us about the confusion and the clarification. Those are the interlinks. On the web, the interlink with that is the more that somebody can get onto our web page, download the publication, the less they have to call and ask us for it. So we are seeing some correlation there in terms of the better our web becomes, the slight drop we get in phone calls.
Well, and I think one thing that you have in your favor is that the people that you serve are very savvy on the web, and they consider that to be a real possible place to go for the information.
Yes. Many teachers, however, still only have access to computers at their schools. And so, you know, it's at home who has them in their homes issue. But it is phenomenal, the continued rise of web contacts and emails that we're getting. And
Representative March, we have made note of your concerns. And when we come back to discuss the performance measures, we'll bring those back up.
Thank you.
So I guess in conclusion, at least on this piece, most of these are efficiency measures for in-office practices.
Madam Chair,
or Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Are we still talking about the links to the Oregon benchmarks?
Yes.
No.
Talk to me about it. I just want to make the point that on yesterday we established that Oregon is especially challenged in needing to develop multiculturally competent educators. And so I see the need for a goal and performance measures related to activities that will lead the way to a multiculturally competent profession. And as I have reviewed the existing links and performance measures, that reference isn't there, and it needs to be.
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, I think that's a great idea. I think intellectually I've incorporated it in things that we do inside the office, just haven't visually. I think that's a great place for it.
Can we have that one noted also and brought back up for discussion when we do the benchmarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Moving on to our workload statistics, which I can actually do very quickly because we've talked about these quite a bit, is the next slide is here. I mentioned the 15,000 or so emails, the 19,000 licenses we process. That would be initial applications, renewals, expedited license that school districts ask for, and those types of transactions. About 6,500 to 7,000 of those are the new licenses, and the rest are renewals and other actions related to licenses. We take formal action on about 200 disciplines. Now, what that means is the complaint has been received and they are processed in some manner with regard to being dismissed or move forward, move to hearing, settled, stipulated, or some other action like that. And then we approve, and when I say approve, 4 to 5 teacher education programs per year, I mean we make the site visits. The program that will be coming in March is Lesley University from Connecticut, and they're the first new program to be approved in 4 years. So new programs aren't coming on board that frequently. Right now we have 18 institutions. Let me quickly give you a picture of the licensed educators and move on to teacher education. 60,200 plus are active licensed educators. That's how many folks, like I think I mentioned yesterday, keep their licenses active. 32,000 approximately are employed. This would be everyone, including the administrators, and just over 26,000 are the teachers in the public schools. You'll see these statistics reflected in the supply and demand report also. We know about 2,000 are employed in the private schools, and we know that by contacts to our office because private schools do not require licensure, although in Oregon most private schools do like to have licensure. So a high percentage of our private school teachers are licensed. And I, as I told you yesterday, 40% of them come from in the state. 63% of our licensees are female. 68% and 30%, and you see that doesn't line up. 2% don't declare their gender, and we don't attempt to discern what it is, just so that you know. And 3.5% of this workforce has self-identified themselves as underrepresented other than white, and it's interesting to note in that statistic that 11% of applicants do not identify. It's really only about, that's the known out of 89% who do report some type of ethnic or racial association.
Why would someone from out of state want an Oregon license?
Those would be applicants who are coming to work in this state from out of state.
Okay, so these aren't people that are somewhere else and are just collecting licenses from some kind of...
It's a good distinction because by keeping our eye on it, we can track the Oregon graduates, which is a better connection, again, to the program preparation. When someone comes in out of state, their initial application cost them $90, which is related to our fee bill. We didn't change that fee. After that, they're an Oregonian for all intents and purposes. For us, their renewals are at Oregon. Everyone renews at the same rate. And so the reason it costs more is we do have to do more evaluation on those files with regard to their experience and their education, and it takes more time. So,
If I might respond, Pat Evenson Brady, Representative Morgan, in the border areas of the state, we have a great deal, and we're largely the rural areas of the state, we have a great deal of difficulty in attracting Oregon-prepared educators to our positions. When you talk about teacher shortages, overall in the state, there are plenty of second language teachers. In rural areas, there's a desperate shortage. And so we're required to look at folks from out of state. So I think you'd find, I've not seen this analysis, but certainly the anecdotal evidence that I hear about is that many of the new teachers in rural areas are in fact coming from out of state because many of them come from Washington and Idaho.
So conversely, does that mean then that a lot of the teachers that we're graduating go somewhere else? I mean, if we're getting this big influx and we're graduating teachers and there doesn't appear to be a lot of growth in the job pool, what are happening to our graduates?
I think the phenomenon that I have been told is that a lot of folks who go to school to become a teacher don't want to leave the area where they went to school. And a full, at least 10 of our 18 institutions, for example, are in Portland. And they're not all going to get jobs there. So I can't explain it otherwise. I think that Oregon graduates are attractive to our school districts. We just don't produce enough to meet the demand.
Again, my experience in going to candidate fairs is that there are tons of out-of-state recruiters there that are coming to candidate fairs in Oregon to recruit particularly our teachers who have second language competence. And they will pay bonuses. In many districts, they offer incentives such as a down payment on a house or a housing allowance. Many of them have much more generous professional development offerings. And so my own experience is that we are competing in a very tough job market for Oregon graduates.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to move on to the program approval piece of what we do. The next three slides will show you the institutions that have approved teacher education programs. The first slide, all the public institutions do except for Oregon OTI, technology. OIT? OIT. That shows you how old I am. OIT doesn't have one, and OHSU, which is, as you know, partly private now anyway, doesn't have a teacher preparation program. And then there are the 12 private institutions that have a teacher preparation program. The University of Phoenix offers an initial administrative training program only. just so that you know, they do not have a teacher per se education program. And the piece that is new that I brought to you that I'd like to point out is the information on the teacher education programs that has a white front to it. What I brought is I left here yesterday feeling that Senator Gordley felt that it was sort of a gamble whether or not colleges were doing things and training students in a good way. And without going into great detail, what I brought for you are the rules, which are actually some of the most clear and concise that we have with regard to the standards that we would be looking at when we make a program visit, and everything that a university has to do to teach and train a new teacher, including the requirements for practica and student teaching, and the knowledge standards that they have to accomplish. These are what the site teams look at when they go there is very, very important, because we are taking the university's word that they have accomplished these standards with the candidates when they send us a C2 form. And that's how it was when I graduated from teacher education too at Western Oregon. If I completed the program and the college said that I completed it satisfactorily and the college had assessed that my student teaching had gone satisfactorily, then I was recommended for a license. What the universities have to do is show that they've kept records on every single candidate about exactly how long that person's student taught, and that they've kept records on the standards that they've used to measure their student teaching, and they're very objective standards.
Madam Chair,
Senator Gordley.
Do we have a method of ranking our Oregon teacher education programs between the public and the independent institutions? Are we able to say, for example, that institution A is the best institution for a given approach to education? For example, if I wanted to focus on the multicultural competence area, are we able to say which of those institutions is the leading institution, so that if a student said, that's where I want to go, we're able to lead them in that direction?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, no, we do not. I think that the commission, I don't know why, and the universities have resisted being ranked. I think that they're going to, it's a new world. I don't think we can resist any longer. The Higher Education Act and the reporting for quality teacher education programs does require that we do some proactive type of assessment like that. And Oregon has maintained that since the candidate has to pass a test, has to pass a basic skills test, the competencies test, and have graduated from the program, 100% of the program completers then are qualified to become licensed. And then what purpose, they say, then would it make to be ranked? The question it begs is talking about the people that have been enrolled in their programs that we don't call program completers because they haven't completed for some reason, failure of student teaching or failure of the test or some other reason. I'm just being frank with you. So it's a little bit disingenuous for us to say that every graduate of every Oregon teacher preparation program completes the program. They do try to assess on admission whether a candidate will complete the program so that there is an open admission and high rates of failure. But I think we have solid objective evidence that there is a percentage, and I don't know what that percentage is, of people who aren't completing their programs that we don't talk about because they don't get licensed, because they don't meet the licensure requirements. And the reason I know that is by looking at the test results that I get from the Education Testing Service, I know that in the neighborhood of about 20 to 25% of all the folks who take the multiple subjects test, which is what we require for elementary teachers, don't pass it, at least on any given test-taking time. That doesn't mean that person might not pass the next time they take it. So in answer to your question, right now we do not. I think it's an unavoidable subject this year with our reporting for Title II. So
I would just say, as a follow-up comment, Madam Chair and members, we spent quite a bit of energy last session in my office reviewing the teaching programs at the public and independent institutions, focusing on the approach to achieving multicultural competence for educators, and also looking at how students or teachers are being prepared to teach reading and being prepared to teach math. With that said, I can tell you where we think some of the strongest programs are, and leading the way is Western Oregon University. And I will leave it at that. I'm glad to hear that it's acknowledged that this is an area that where we need to do a lot of work quickly. And your response focused on how whether students are completing programs or not, and we need to focus on what is the strength of the program, the educational program that the students are participating in.
We can, Madam Chair, and excuse me.
Senator Gordley, I think your comment is real interesting, and what it brings to my mind is the resource allocation model that the higher ed folks are moving along with, and how that will, I think, result in specialization
yes.
on the campuses. And it would seem that there's some crossover here that we should maybe explore when we get those folks in.
Absolutely.
Oh, I'm sorry. I really didn't take a vacation. I was listening to you, so I lost my thought, Madam Chair. I know you folks have a lot of work, but it's really clear that you're interested in this area. And the commission last meeting had a report from Dale Shalock at the who works at the Research Center at Western Oregon University. He did a fascinating study. What they did is they followed for 3 years brand new educators out of Oregon programs, and they initially assessed them, and they had people assessed at what they considered the rock bottom for performance, and then what they assessed is in 3 years how quickly they became efficient or high-performing teachers. And then they assessed what happened to high-performing teachers who started in the first year, and it's fascinating because the curve goes like this. And there isn't any the most compelling factor in that is the culture of the school.
Yes.
Oh,
and
yeah.
the effect of the culture of the school. And so, and what they found is in schools that had cultures that weren't as nurturing as others, high-performing teachers' performance dropped over a period of 3 years significantly. So I say that not to defend the colleges, but that it was a point I was trying to make yesterday, that once I've graduated, a lot of my development is in the hands of what I do next. And so it is worth listening to him if you have time to have him come in and present that, because it's fascinating. The commission, you could have heard a pin drop in there for an hour, because until you do the research, how would you know? So,
Senator Messer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vicki, that's a perfect segue, an area that I wanted to try to lead you in. And if you're going to go there, say so, and I'll take it. My concern is that I think what we've been hearing about is the coursework and the requirements up to licensing. And what I'm interested in is the process is different, primarily for the upper graduate courses post-licensing. And it's a little hard for me to think of that, because I used to think that you needed a bachelor's degree to teach. Now I understand you need a master's degree, so I might be a little bit confused here. But I'm concerned about if you are the board that reviews those credits and those coursework. When I was on the school board, we had some problems with staff getting double credits. It was taking it 1 year and then going back a year or two later. And by being an assistant professor or something, getting double credit for it. And And we found that, so I'm interested whether you monitor that and whether those credits are going, if that's your role. Now, that might be the school district's role to monitor that as well. But who sponsors the upper division courses and how you review those courses, both for advanced study as well as for administrative certificates?
Madam Chair, Senator Messlerly, there's about 8 questions in there. And I'm going to go backwards. The administrator graduation courses are well defined in their preparation program, and that's between the TSBC's approval process and the institution. The part of what I heard you ask was professional development. Any graduate credit that contributes to my licensure, it's not economical for a candidate to duplicate in that regard. Back in the old days under the old licensure system, however, all candidate had to do was get a fifth year's worth of graduate credits. They only needed 15 in their area of expertise, and 30 could be any graduate credits. And once they acquired the 45 graduate credits, this was up until 1999, they could get their last stage standard license. And this is where I think the problem comes in with you. School districts did catch people who were doing exactly what you were saying. And because it early when I started teaching in the late 70s, you still had to bring your transcript in. They compared it to other transcripts that I had submitted, and then I would get reimbursement if I was working toward my program. Other school districts said, well, you have $400 a summer to get your graduate credit, and they didn't review what it did. So it's a local district accountability piece at that piece. And we do not monitor the quality of professional development. The legislature didn't give us that authority. All we do is ask that the districts are responsible for monitoring the quality and quantity of professional development. We verify it when we license them. The district verifies that their students have received, their teachers and administrators have received so much professional development. Does that answer your question?
That is partially it. It is very helpful. And again, my experience is back a few years. But at one point, the upper division courses were sponsored by the University of Oregon and the OEA. And it always seemed to me, at least as far as the perception, that that might be a conflict of interest. Particularly, I'm more concerned now if that's still going on, if there is no oversight from your perspective. Because where that takes you is that they do increase in the salary scale. I mean, that's
right.
And it was my observation that when I first started working on the school board, that it was taking 15 or so years to go from the beginning teacher to the top level. And I believe today that time frame is much, much shorter. And so my concern is that if they are valid courses, they are really helping the teachers improve their skill levels, that's valid. But what you just told me is that the graphs show that maybe their needs are not being met in improving those skills. If I read what you're talking about,
don't be afraid
this is
to
just
say it.
Directly connected to the master's degree requirement issue, I think is partially where you're heading, truthfully. I don't think we have the same problem today in new licensure that we have in the old system with graduate credit. Now, I say that, but I have to tell you this. 1% of our teachers have new licenses. 99% have old licenses. That means 99% of teachers can be going out and doing precisely what you're saying today. There's nothing to stop them except the school district. And now the political statement I'm going to make is that our salary schedules were designed at a different era. They went bachelor's plus 15, bachelor's plus 30, bachelor's plus 45, which was different than master's, and that was the general format for the school district salary schedule pay. And it was generally 3 to 4% between the columns and 3-4% between the steps. So it was dramatic. School districts never hired a brand new master's teacher. It was too expensive. You know, it was 12% higher than a bachelor's graduate. That's what's run into the new licensure system, I think, in a lot of ways in terms of cost. And so a keen look has to be looked at the design of that salary schedule, because the legislature directed a redesign of teacher education in the late 80s and early 90s. And so the public institutions were required to move from bachelor degree education programs to master's degree education programs. No one talked about the fiscal impact then. They didn't worry about it. That was as we typically do things. We'll do this in higher ed, and you do that in K-12, and then when there's a collision, we'll figure out how to fix it. 75% of the Oregon graduates graduate with a master's degree because they get their bachelor's in their major degree area first, and then they get their education training in a master's degree. That's what's happened with this pay schedule issue, and it's been happening since about 1993, which was before our licensure system. So that's a piece of the master's degree issue, just so that you're aware. The rest of it is on our plate, and is a good policy question about there is research evidence that shows that a bachelor's degree graduate who's been through education, there has an education undergraduate, is no better as a new teacher than a master's degree education prepared teacher. That's a different statement than if I got my bachelor's degree in teaching and then went and got my master's degree, what that may have contributed to my teaching. Does that make some sense there? So is that helpful in the discussion?
Can I ask just a personal clarification question? The salary schedule with the steps and the experience, whose responsibility is it to formulate that?
Each of the individual school districts, because they're each individual governments, local governments.
And do they do that under the guidance of some certain group or body or?
Madam Chair, the School Boards Association now is highly relied upon for data and research and support in that regard. But do they all get together and compare notes and say, how could we do it differently? I think the answer is no. They all have different funding. Even it's not so much anymore, but it used to be wildly different under the old local property tax funding. So this is, again, a trickle-down, I think, result of what happens when all your money evens out and you're all different. You're all equal now. And so there's no requirement except for from you that be different.
Well, I can clearly see the problem with the salary schedule and crashing into the way that most people come into teaching now, where they get a bachelor's in some field and then add the additional 2 years to get their teaching credential.
Correct.
Madam Chair. I just have a follow-up statement. This has been very helpful for me, and I think we need to continue this discussion when we get into the K-12 budgets, because it would appear to me that this is taking a tremendous amount of cash.
Yes.
To fund this master's degree requirement, and you know, I don't know that we're ever going to back that up. That's probably the water's going under the bridge, but I am concerned if we're getting better quality teachers by this requirement, or is it simply costing education?
I think that's a logical question. How many teachers are coming in now with a master's degree?
And we're hearing 75%. Senator Messerly and Madam Chair, if I could just respond to the quality question. I have the privilege of being an adjunct professor at Portland State and teaching in a master's program. It's offered in Hood River and attracts students from Washington and the Hood River, Wasco County. I mean, we actually had folks drive over from Sandy because they said parking was better in Hood River than in Portland. So it tells you some of the things that impact on teachers. These are veteran teachers. We had no one in the cohort who had taught for less than 5 years. We did three of those cohorts over 6 years. about 20 students per cohort, so 50 to 60 teachers. Because I worked in the district, I got to see what happened to those teachers post that program and the kind of instructional leadership that they developed, their ability to deal with, and we emphasized heavily dealing with test data, looking at what you're doing in the classroom, looking at your data, using that as a continuous improvement model. Those folks became leaders in their schools in teaching other teachers how to use that data. Now, again, this is a single program. This is 50 folks, 50 veteran teachers. But I wouldn't want you to leave with the impression that those courses are not valuable and useful. What those students told us, those educators told us, was this is the point in my professional life when I can use this learning. I've taught now. I have some questions. I come to you prepared to get that information and to take it back into the classroom. And it's been one of the best professional experiences of my life to work with those teachers and to really see my work as a teacher change their work as a teacher in a way that I couldn't do with the limited staff development in service that we were able to offer in our district. So I want to tell you there is the potential of some very powerful outcomes as the result of that added instruction.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, excuse me, that was the distinction I was trying to make between the difference between a new teacher coming out with a master's degree and the value of a potential master's degree in another area. And I do want to clarify for you, 75% of Oregon graduates come out with a master's degree today because of the redesign of the programs. But earlier, if you recall, I told you 40% of our new licensees are Oregon graduates. So therefore, if 75% of 40% is 30% of the whole, so 30% of the whole come out with new licensees coming either from out of state or into Oregon about have master's degree. I don't have a percentage for you about what percentage of our out-of-state folks coming in have master's degree, but only 10 states require a master's degree. The vast majority of the folks who come to us from out-of-state do not have master's degrees.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm sure this has been expressed, and I just didn't pick up on it. But so an out-of-stater is allowed to come in with a bachelor's degree, and then they have what is the time frame that they are required to get their master's?
That's what these materials were about that I brought you. If they have 9 years.
Please proceed.
Thank you. If you'll allow me to skip through the teacher accountability piece, but let me highlight this. Our accountability features for the license are passage of a subject matter test, passage of a basic skills test, and completion of a teacher education program. Those are the three primary accountability pieces we have for licensure. So just so that you know, so most out-of-state teachers cannot come into Oregon and get the first stage license because many of them have not taken any competency tests in subject matter area. Under No Child Left Behind, that is going to go away with regard to testing. That is the top federal marker for competency, is having passed the Praxis test or some other competency area subject matter test like that. So just so that you know, all Oregon teachers have been doing that since 1991. And so we're one of the few states that are ahead, at least on that issue. Recent achievements, that's the synopsis of four slides. So I'm now to the recent achievements, and this gets to our public service issue that you've talked about. Part of the phone issue we've done with our public teacher lookup, and I'm going to show you what that looks like. The new voicemail system that we've implemented, and adding phone lines. I think, and we've had frequently asked questions. This web page has only been up since March last year, so it's been up for 11 months, and the feedback has been phenomenal. One of the things that we do now is that we send out renewal notices by emails to the school districts and to the teacher. And starting last month, what we do is 6 months after you get your license, we send out a notice and say, this is what we told you you need to do to get your next stage license. a year from now, we'll send that back out to them, because what happens is that we send them a letter when they get their license and say, you need to know that in the next 3 years you need to get these requirements done. And then about 4 months before their license expires, they pull the letter out and realize that they haven't passed a test or, you know, done something. And this is to prevent that. We run into crises all the time. I didn't know I had to take that test. And we pulled out the two-year-old letter or three-year-old letter and say, yes, but it says right here. So we figure we're going to do some preventative measures by sending them annually what their requirements are that they have to meet for their next stage license. That's a brand-new feature that we're really excited about. So we also have had received...
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Do you also notify the school district, their employer?
Yes, actually.
They can keep track if they're not a...
The statute says that we're supposed to notify the school district only, but that didn't make sense to me either, because sometimes things get pigeonholed on desks, so we are doing the candidate to the extent we have the ability to communicate with them that way and the school district. So,
So all of the teachers that are not teaching have to keep their credentials current also, or do you have like an inactive status type of license?
Madam Chair, they may go inactive if they choose to have their license reinstated. They would need some recency, and that would mean like 9 hours of any kind of college credit to renew their license under the old system. So... any type of possible work in a private school that's related to their license or things like that. So they are not required to, and it's fairly easy to get your license reinstated. My license has been inactive since 1985. I've done a lot of teaching since then, but it has to be within the last 3 years before you want your license to be active. I would have to acquire some credit to reinstate my license. So... just want to quickly show you a little bit about the website before we show you more about how we use our budget. I think we have a data repository. I just want you to know this so that anybody from the public can get on and now go, okay, I want to know what percentage of all the teaching workforce are females or what percent are. And that is 90% complete. It's been funded with grant monies, part of it from Wallace Reader's Digest and part of it from federal grants through the Oregon University System. So this is our home web page, and we've tried to keep it very simple. So what you have here is we're going to link to the commission and hit the next slide. And if you hit the commission link on the left drop-down list, you'll see in red there the commission meetings. And if you click on the commission meetings, you will then get our future meeting dates and our past meetings that have links to the agenda and the approved materials. I just wanted to show you that. You can keep going. Okay. And then the next thing I wanted to show you is how the online services work. So if you click on the online services... It would take you to, here's a various services. The first one is the teacher licensure inquiry. This is the one that I particularly like. There's no excuse for any school district to say they don't know what kind of license their teacher has. First of all, they're supposed to have them, and they're supposed to know. But every once in a while you go, oh, I didn't look on the back. I don't know. Anyway, you can type in any educator's name here and the last four numbers of their Social Security number and pull up, go ahead. A license that tells you what their endorsements are, how long it's active, whether it's active, and when it expires. In addition, up in the yellow line up at the top, it'll tell them if they're in the process of a renewal, whether we have recently received something on it or that their license is being considered for renewal right now. And that helps also reduce the phone calls. Did you get my stuff? Did you get my letter? Did you get my materials? So what do we have next here? The online service account. Each one of you may go on to the online services and sign up for an online service account, which would give you an email notice of our next meeting, any news releases we have, any reason we'd want to get a hold of you. So by filling in your email account information. And if you'll pardon me for a second, is there anything else you'd like me to say about that?
Just that if Pat could go to the next slide. You'll notice on the bottom you're able...
could you come up
excuse
to
me.
The
yes.
microphone
and say
the you on the record?
For the record, Larry Warren, TSPC office manager. The slide we're looking at now shows the section where you would set up your account. And I just wanted to point out that on the bottom of that account, you're able to choose what type of services you want to be notified about. So if you sign up and you later realize you're getting too many emails or you're not interested in a particular area, you can go back and unsubscribe to one of those services. Mm-hmm. And then if I could, I want to back up. On this section here on the teacher license inquiry, one of the things I'd like to point out is that you have the option of looking up by just name, and that would be a general search. Anyone in the public could do that. And you also notice we have a spot for the birth date and the last four digits of the Social Security number. If an individual knew that information, which would typically be their employer or the individual themselves, when they went to this screen, they would get a lot more information than what you're seeing here. They would be able to see any letters that TSPC sent to them and whether it's associated particularly with the license. It would say whether their fingerprints have cleared, and it would tell them any recent forms that we have received. And so, again, they would have to know a little bit of information about the person to get to that information. But this search here is a generic search that anyone from the public can do.
Thank you.
The TSPC challenges, Madam Chair, if I may move on, in our opinion, are our ability, we're going to have to ramp up to comply with No Child Left Behind. Most of our data, lack of data, is because of lack of staff to do data input. We are moving to scanning technology, which means we'll be able to barcode our applications that is in the beginning processes, and that data then will go by barcode into our data system, which is a huge resource saver. But that starts today and doesn't take care of the already 60,000 issue. And we and at least for the people who are employed, have to get up to speed with their credentials, because that's one of the federal requirements for reporting. There hasn't been any reason for us to put into the data the exact master's and bachelor's unless it related to their license. And that's a key point, because Senator Messerly's case, a lot of teachers acquired master's degrees to advance on the pay schedule, but it had nothing to do with licensure, and they weren't necessarily compelled to tell us whether they had one if it wasn't required for their licensure. So that's why our data wouldn't ever be very good in terms of reporting the percentage of master's degrees, et cetera. We want to catch that up, and we'll have to be working with the school districts to do it. The school districts will have to report that to us now. We receive all of our data, just so that you know, from the Department of Education in the fall school reports, so that districts don't have to do things twice. So, because the data that they give the Department of Ed is very useful to us, too, and we don't ask them to make other reports to us. The fee bill that we've requested is only a $15 increase on our licensure fee from $60 to $70 and $60 to $75. Our licensure fee is good for 3 to 5 years, so that's about a $5 a year increase for an applicant. What we've done is we've calculated that fee increase would allow us to hire the staff that would plug the holes in our public service challenges, to get our licenses out more quickly, to implement our scanning technology, and to process our disciplines more quickly, and to look at the barriers to recruiting and retaining a more diverse workforce. And this is what I was implying to Senator Gordley. I've incorporated it into the thinking, hadn't put it as an active goal. There is objective evidence that the underrepresented teacher candidates fail the subject matter tests at higher rates than the white majority population candidates. So ETS will tell you there are no cultural barriers in their tests, but the evidence does not indicate that. And so really what the commission needs to do is look at how do we have a fair alternative assessment if somebody cannot pass a test, if it's presenting a barrier to getting someone into the classroom. Where I'm really going to have a challenge is making sure we can do that and have teachers be considered highly qualified by the federal government under No Child Left Behind when testing is such a big issue for the federal government. So that allows me to move into...
Senator Gordley, do you have a comment?
I do. Thank you. And again, I just want to appreciate and acknowledge the focus and the attention that's being given to this particular area by the TSPC. I think roughly 10 years ago, the legislature passed, I believe the title was the Minority Teacher Recruitment Act, again, legislation. And there was a report of the findings and recommendations released last session to the governor. And that report was very explicit about, you know, what are the barriers and what need to be the next steps toward recruitment and retention of people of color to become educators. I'm wondering how that report is being used in your work, but also want to make a request that the report be made available to this committee so that we have familiarity as we look at the performance measure piece of your work.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the as you mentioned, the governor's office is responsible for producing that report, although we do give them the data. Because of the transition in the governor's office, the Oregon University System has taken on the update of that report. And it's my understanding they expect it to be complete and published by March. I know we got them the data several weeks ago, and they're compiling that. So we can get you a current, at least through 2002, updated report in March. And it sounds like we might be back after that, so we could tie it into our discussion.
Ms. Chamberlain, I heard you say, I think, that the commission was going to take up the issue of trying to figure out an alternate route for minorities to get through the testing process. Would it be possible to put in the what goes out in the budget for the 05-07 session that the members that are sitting on the committee at that time be aware that this is happening and ask for an update on how that process is going?
Madam Chair, that would be possible. We could put something in the budget report that the TSPC is to report back to the next legislative assembly.
I think that would be very worthwhile. Senator Messerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to hopefully stay on the track here, but I want to take a different approach to it, I guess. And that is that we've seen charter schools come in. We've seen a lot of homeschools come through. And quite frankly, when I served on the school board, I was very cautious about homeschooling because I was concerned that some parents might be doing it for the wrong reasons. What I've seen here, at least, and the people that have come through my office in the Capitol, that they've done some extremely good job. We've also seen some TV documentaries nationwide, I think, some very successful different types of schools. And my question is, how do you prepare and how do you measure the teacher's ability to motivate and to encourage students, which I think they're really showing this to be a key factor in the type of education. And although I recognize that the basic knowledge in the subject areas is very, very important, the motivating the teachers and, I mean, the students and the and how the contact time is valuable is really a very, very becoming, we're recognizing that to be a major, major factor, I think.
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, it's a... I have part of a fairly good answer, and the rest may not be that great. I think it's the the thing to remember that the motivation issue is primarily in the hands of the school district, and that is that if you're a new teacher, whether they've given them a quality mentor and provided support systems and assisted the new teacher and the veteran teacher, However, I think that was a factor we recognized as important and has been incorporated into the new licensure system. So under Oregon's new licensure system, you can't become permanently licensed till you can prove to us you can teach. And you have to do that in conjunction with an approved program. And the statute allows us, which we're talking about in the House Ed Committee right now, for a school district and an ESD to work with a university or to provide a program like that. So I have to prove to you I can teach French, not just go out and get more French in a master's degree, let's say. And there isn't a real, there isn't a scientific way to measure whether or not a teacher can motivate students, but it goes without saying that if a teacher cannot motivate students, it's unlikely they can lead them to learning gains, and there are objective ways to measure learning gains, how they're performing at the end of the year after being pre-tested, and that's what I would have to prove to get my permanent license in Oregon now, but that's just from now on. And affects only about 1% of our workforce now. And as people retire and new people come in, as you know, that'll grow. But all of the folks under the old licensure system were grandfathered in. So to sum that up, the primary responsibility is in the hands of the district today.
I can follow up, Madam Chair. And I recognize it's very important to make it even more difficult. Sisters that are very good teachers. And in our family discussions at dinners and things, we've talked about some of the challenges. Different classes will have totally different personalities and be much more challenging or much, much easier. Also, the system, the legislature, the system has placed mandates on teachers, which in many cases makes it more difficult, I'm sure, just from the demands on their time and their energy for different types of classes, too. So. I recognize it's not a simple thing at all.
Senator Gordley. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. You used the phrase grandfathered in, and that reminded me of a question I wanted to ask earlier. How many, under the new system, how many teachers are grandfathered in, total numbers, and that percentage out of the total workforce?
I'm not looking at you blankly. I'm only trying to recall the exact number. 26,000 and about, I think, 300 of our teachers are employed. And of those teachers, about 2,950 of them are in the new licensure system. So about 1%. Just slightly over 1% of our new of our teaching workforce is in the new system.
Madam Chair, that has implications, again, for No Child Left Behind, in that the majority of our, I'm stating the obvious, but the majority of our teachers are in the old system. And so, again, what is the process and plan to make sure that that group of educators get the tools and skills and resources they will need to meet the higher standards that are being set under No Child Left Behind?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, about 80% of our workforce meet the No Child Left Behind standards because they've had to have passed the tests. But that begs the question of how do they get the skills to address the disaggregated groups that were being required to under federal law? And it's my understanding that's the purpose of the federal money now is supposed to be spent primarily on professional development for the existing workforce to help with this. And that's part of what the Department of Education has to track in their state plan, is that these resources are being used to assist teachers, the existing workforce, who meet the definition of highly qualified. And also the federal money is supposed to assist that if they don't meet the definition of highly qualified, how the district is going to help their teachers get to that level. So is that?
Yes, that's very helpful. And again, for this committee, one of the critical monitoring pieces for us will be, from a budget standpoint, is making sure that the dollars are being
yes.
to the students, disaggregated group of students,
who are supposed to receive the benefits under No Child Left Behind. And it's a critical area because if we look at past practice, past history in our state, we have something called ESL funding. And we know that ESL dollars have not always been spent on ESL students in our districts around the state. I don't want to point any fingers here, but that has been a problem documented. And again, we're going to need to hone in and make sure that we understand where these dollars are supposed to flow and if those dollars are actually getting to those students who are supposed to benefit. Please proceed.
Thank you. One of the questions that the committee has asked is how the agency uses its budget, and in broad general terms, we use about 57.5%, I'm on the slide on page 8 of the handout, on licensure, which is the primary work we do, about not quite 22% on the discipline professional censures, and about 10% on program approval, 3.5%, this came up yesterday, on commission meetings. That's all the costs, the substitute replacements, et cetera, that we have to travel, incur for the 5 commission meetings. About 4.5% on maintaining our information technology, and that's that database resource I was explaining to you, and keeping the web updated and the scanning technology. And then about 1.8% is what we account for our ability today to get out and help spread the word, and that would be primarily me and the person who's a coordinator of program approval traveling to talk about licensure. Just quickly, I don't need to dwell on it. Here is our organizational chart, which is also in the budget. And if you can look on the left-hand side, if you're looking at it, it is still, Larry, it's like looking in a mirror. The licensure is on the right side, and the other, in my other one, it was a foot plot, but most of our staff are either doing information technology support for the licensure system or evaluating licenses and providing public service. The outcomes that could be expected from our budget if it's approved, I think, would be our ability to continue to expand our web services. Today, we can't take visa payments online. This has a lot to do with coordinating our technology with the Department of Administrative Services and getting the security that we need to do that. It would also allow us to hire some temporary staff because we're going to have to go in and input data from the files to do the No Child High Quality Teaching reporting that we're going to be required to do. And it would also allow us to provide information to teacher education programs. They're really, in other words, we could then tell them, you know, 50% of your graduates have been hired and they're in these schools. And that can become ready information if we can continue our data input that we need to do. And we honestly believe it will allow us to speed up our processing of licensure. The use and time for all of the positions that we've requested one public service representative to do the phone call email, as I explained to you. We've requested one office specialist, one. This is a result. This person will be able to assist in the data input, but this person also would help us take care of the security issues that were raised by the Secretary of State in the audit. We receive all of our money into our office, and as you can see, our budget is over $3 million. And the concern the Secretary of State office is one person pretty much brings that in, and Larry is the check on that. And we don't have any problems and haven't lost any money, but that's not how you handle money in a business. And they'd like us to have, you know, the other person there to do that. We just haven't had the staff to do it.
Have you explored using a lockbox?
Madam Chair, yes, we have. Actually, our money is deposited every single day. And let me invite Larry up to exactly what we do with the money right now so you can get the precision. Thank you.
Larry Warren, for the record. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the concern the auditors had was not so much around the physical security of the money.
The separation of...
But the as the money's coming in the door, the individual putting the money in their pocket rather than putting it into the TSP.
And then having no balance or no check and balance on that part of the process.
And currently, we keep with the Department of Administrative Rules that all money received is deposited within 24 hours. So we don't have a large amount of cash just sitting there in our office. That the cash that is sitting there is behind a lockbox. That there's only two individuals in the office that have keys to that.
Well, what I'm wondering about is, I think it is very common in the private sector for businesses where there is a lot of remittance payments for whatever kinds of invoices that are out there, to have the payee submit the money to a lockback box that's actually inside of a bank, and the bank receives the remittance and then sends an advice back to the business about what it was that they received, and then any supporting documentation that came along with the check or the money order or whatever it was. And I'm wondering if you've explored just using that third-party relationship with the bank so that you don't have the cash at all in the department.
Madam Chair, that's something that I have not explored, although that sounds very interesting to me, and I will certainly look into that with our bank and see what services they offer. My only concern would be if it slowed down our processing time at all.
Well, in my experience with it in the private sector is that you get information the day after the bank receives the payment, and that with electronic transfers becoming even more prevalent, that information is being transmitted very quickly. And you can imagine in the private sector where, you know, your survival depends on you being able to process those receivables quickly, that the banks are very responsive.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I will definitely look into that.
Representative Marks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Several of the other licensing boards were using that, and DAS, I'm sure, can help you connect up with them. The other question I had is, what percentage of your, so we'll call it business, your licensure is walk-in versus mail-in? Do you have people walking in and handing you cash with their transcripts, et cetera?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do have members of the public come in and submit money that way. And I would say it's probably less than 5%. And those individuals do receive a receipt. Those people are typically paying in cash rather than a check, we've found. So receipt, and it's noted into their file. So we have a check and balance there for that money coming across the counter.
Thank you.
Senator Mazzaway.
Maybe I'm out of place. I was going to ask a money question. It's time to do that.
Have at.
Okay, thank you. I noticed on page 9 of the budget document, the beginning balance is 24%. My calculations, roughly that's running several months of beginning balances. It seems rather high.
Larry.
Yeah. I'm in the main binder. Yes, I'm sorry.
Ms. Ames, do you want to address that?
Yeah, I can say. Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, you are
for
correct.
The record, please.
Oh. I shouldn't forget that. I'm Linda Ames with Department of Administrative Services.
Thank you.
And you are correct. They're coming into this biennium with a fairly high beginning balance, more than we would normally have. Revenues have been coming in a little higher than we had anticipated. The other trouble with a fee-driven agency is you do a fee increase, and then you tend to have a little too much money for a while, and then after a while you don't. I mean, you tend to have some years with a higher balance, and then over time, as inflation and other programs cause you to need the funding, it goes down. Now, what we have done in their budget, and we'll see it as we go into more detail, is even with the fee increase, if we approve their policy packages as they requested, they will end the biennium with about a 2.5 month balance. So that is more in line with where we normally try to keep ending balances.
Okay. Thank you.
The positions that you're proposing to add, are they permanent positions?
Madam Chair, yes, they are permanent positions. The position I didn't mention was a half-time investigator. We had asked for a full-time investigator, but it's very difficult to project precisely what a full-time investigator would mean in terms of speeding things up, and I think the thinking was that we could do it two ways. If we could attempt to hire somebody half-time for the biennium and see what kind of dent that made, or we could hire somebody full-time for the first year, and if it was very evident that that was making a huge impact on our ability to speed up processing in cases, come back to you in the middle of the biennium.
So
and
you would be open to making them limited duration rather than permanent positions?
Madam Chair, yes, and having to justify to you that that has accomplished what we've expected, yes, I think that's reasonable.
I think also that when we get into work session and discuss the fee increase, that the committee would benefit from a more detailed analysis of the ending balance and then the impact of the fee increase on an ongoing basis.
Perhaps a bit of cash flow. You have an annual license cycle plus also applications coming in at a different time.
And I am thinking of a cash flow analysis,
yeah,
so the committee can judge where you're going to end up at the end of the 03-05 biennium, the end of the 05-07 biennium, with the fee increase in place. Please proceed. We got a chance of getting done with this.
Madam Chair, we actually have gone to all the way through our slides. I haven't talked about in detail, but maybe it would be more appropriate in work session when we do the cash flow analysis, is the fee bill itself. What I prepared for you was the how we believe we would be using those fees and the other challenges and some of the things that I think that we need to connect with regard to our work is all the responsibilities we have other than the customer service and things like that. And this gets back to some of our discussion yesterday with doing the test alignments and connecting it with the Department of Education student standards and making sure they're reasonable to ask teachers to take those tests. Those alignment studies are supposed to be done once every 5 years, and TSPC's only done about a third of them since 1994. So that's in addition to our work. I think that if we do this analysis that you want, it may be a little bit easier to see what our workload is. It's I don't feel comfortable I've made it really clear to you, maybe some of the challenges, but maybe we have. Do you?
On the need for the fee increase and what you're going to do with the money?
The work that we're going to have to do over the next biennium. So, for example, I'm absolutely very comfortable with limited duration because I know there's going to be challenges and instant workload needs under No Child Left Behind that are going to last for several months. What we can't project is what the sustained load on the agency will be for complying with the federal government. And the other thing I can't project clearly because the agency hasn't done enough of it is what the alignment costs are going to be to do the test alignments. The study for alternative assessment on multicultural issues will cost some money, but not a lot of money. I think it will have to project out what that impact might be because the only other alternative assessment that we do today is a portfolio analysis to try to determine the teacher's competency if they can't pass the test, and that tends to be a little labor-intensive. We have the ability to charge a fee for that, though, we have not, and we could. So I'm just thinking out loud on that issue. But I think my biggest concern coming into this session and talking to you was that we would be able to meet the public service concerns that this legislature has had about our agency for a long time.
Questions, comments? I never thought we'd make it here at 7 minutes after 10. Ms. Ames, would you like to do the DAS overview?
Okay. Madam Chair, member of the committees, for the record, Linda Ames with Department of Administrative Services, and I'm going to give you the strictly budget view, and it's this handout. There were some left over yesterday, if anyone is not finding that in their packet from yesterday. Okay. Page 2 is the summary of the overall budget. You can see the governor's budget is about $3.9 million. It's all other funds. With the new positions that they've talked about, they'll have 22 positions and 21 full-time equivalent. That is the first time they've really had new positions for base workload for at least 10 years. I went back to 95, 97. They did get a couple positions back in 97 to address specific workload needs of implementing fingerprinting, but most of those people we phased back out once they got through that initial surge of workload. Page 3 is just shows it is all other funds.
One of our favorites.
Yeah.
Plays there.
A little detail about the revenue sources for those other funds. They expect to raise about $3.2 million revenue during 03-05. That together with their substantial beginning balance will allow them to fund this budget with the new staff. About 89% of their revenue next biennium is from licensing, and only about 11% is from fingerprint fees. Almost all the fees from the fingerprint fees are passed on to the FBI and state police to actually provide those services. So it isn't actually revenue that the agency gets to use. They keep 6% or $6 out of the fee, which is about 14%, in order to administer that program. On page 4, the governor's budget's a 13% increase from 0103 at the fifth special session point in time. Special sessions didn't really affect this agency since they are other funds. They did not experience cuts. Roughly speaking, about half the increase in this budget is the roll-up of personal services, the PERS cost, the roll-up of past contracts, and the other half is the new policy packages. Major
Ms. Ames, is this also one of the budgets where the salary roll-ups have not been backed out yet?
Madam Chair, this, like all the budgets, have not had the merit steps taken out.
Thank you.
And additionally, now that management is not going to, or higher management, is not going to get their 3% COLA starting in February, that will be an additional small piece that will be backed out of this budget. And we did actually get a test run on some of this data this week, so we're hoping we're going to start getting that information pinned down so that we can actually have real numbers.
Good time.
Page 5, another one of those graphs. This agency only has one program, their program. Page 6, personal services is about 61% of the budget, while services and supplies 35%. One of the reasons services and supplies is a little higher for this agency than is typical for licensing boards is that they pass through a substantial amount of money for fingerprints that shows up in that category. Some of that money also shows up as the special payments, so those are sort of just odd budgeting categories for money that's passing through. They also have some hardware that they will need to buy for the scanning project, and that's in the capital outlay. Right. On page 7, the step-by-step building of this budget, the 0103 original adopted budget at about $3.1 million. They did go to the April 02 emergency board and were given $244,000 additional limitation and a 0.25 limited duration position for the second year of the biennium. Part of this was limitation for a teacher grant, teacher quality grant that they received through higher ed. And a lot of it was a limitation for moving costs, costs related to a new director, paying off vacation and the search for the new director, paying vacation for the old director, and some costs for additional temporary staffing.
Senator Mesley.
Is the move taking you to the new building on the mall?
Madam Chair, Senator Meserly, they were in the public service building. They were asked to leave the public service building so that Secretary of State could expand, and they are now in a privately owned facility near the downtown, which they intend to stay. They are not anticipating another move. I don't think they would ever want to do that again.
The Marine Board and us occupy about two-thirds of that building, and an accounting firm occupies the other third.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Okay. Madam Chair, most of those expenditures associated with the move, the new director, et cetera, were one time, and what you'll see down in essential packages is we phase out a lot of that limitation. In the e-board, one of their main issues were workload issues. And what the emergency board decided, they gave them the 0.25 FTE for a half-time position that second year. They gave them some funding or limitation for temps for the summer workload. But they asked, they decided this would be a temporary solution for the year and that the agency would come back to this hearing to discuss a permanent solution to these workload problems. Base budget adjustments is $315,000 addition. That's the personal services roll-up costs. The base adjustment also then removes that 0.25 FTE that was limited duration. Limited duration always go away at the end of the current biennium. Essential packages, they had the standard adjustments for inflation, state government service charges, and we did phase out all the one-time expenditures associated with that emergency board. Really, the only expenditures in the emergency board that end up being ongoing is they are paying higher rent in this new facility and higher phone costs than they had in the public service building.
What's the reason for higher phone costs? The system, you're taking on a system that existed there?
Madam Chair, in the private building, we have to rent our phone lines. And previously, when we were in the state building, we didn't have
Thank
to
you.
Do that.
Okay. Page 8 on policy packages. We do have an 090 package, a program reduction package. And I want to be clear that these are things we believe we can take out of their budget if we give them these additional staff, because they will be able to do some of these things with staff rather than a lot of the $70,000 reduction is contracts that they used to do for computer support. Package 101, there are three packages that add the program enhancements. Public service improvements, 157,000 in two positions. One of these is a support staff that will partially replace the limited duration position they had and then partially give them some additional staff for workload issues, and they've described some of those issues. The other is the public service representative to help with emails and phone. And then on the next page, Policy Package 102, the Information Technology Project, that's $171,000 limitation and one full-time staff. This provides a second IT person who will help implement the scanning in lieu of the current system of microfilming and will assist in setting up the credit card payment system.
Ms. Ames, what's the timeline within DAS to get the online credit card payment system actually working?
Madam Chair, that is a very good question, and I do not know exactly where we were at, but it has been a very long time coming. I know Mr. Hill was brought on explicitly to get this e-commerce and credit card payment system moving, and my impression is that it should be ready by now. Let me double check and get back to you on that.
I would appreciate if we could get just a little update. I don't know if Mr. Hill has, you know, some kind of a web page where this information is.
We must be close.
I think that there are a number of us that have been watching the slug-like page.
Yeah, and I know the little boards and commissions have really taken the brunt of this. I looked back at my original work, and this commission was originally promised that they would be a pilot agency, and that was in the summer of 01. That was supposed to be up and running, so we're basically 2 years waiting on this. And meanwhile, the commission has been told that they shouldn't go out and do this on their own completely through some mm-hmm. private vendor, because we want to be sure that we have consistency across agencies and use the power that you have in the centralized approach. So I'll make a note and get back on that.
I think it is worth an editorial comment here that if the private sector had proceeded at this rate, there would be a lot different things would be a lot different out there than they are now. That being able to use a credit card online has had a huge impact on commerce.
If government had run it, we'd still be on a teletype machine, perhaps.
Well, I didn't want to go that far, but
well, my original
you on record saying that rather than me.
My original thought actually was the Morse key code.
Strings and cans. I don't know.
Okay, policy package 103, the discipline caseload package adds a $69,000 limitation and a half-time position, or as she pointed out, she may prefer to use that as a full-time position for 1 year as sort of a test.
I think that we're looking forward to receiving the detailed information on the complaints and the dispensations, and that will figure into the discussion in this area.
Mm-hmm. And finally, on their fee increase, just a couple little details on that. This increase was implemented administratively in January of 2003. That fee increase was originally discussed at the 2001 Ways and Means hearing and tentatively approved and built into that budget. It was originally planned for January of 2002, and they had high enough revenues that they felt they really didn't need it. And obviously, with the beginning balance that they have, they were right. And that, so they already have delayed it 1 year. But it did go into effect then in January. It is the first fee increase they've had since 1994. The new license and renewal fee increase will go from $60 to $75, and that does license, depending on which category, for either a 3-year period or a 5-year period. So
this is, Ms. Ames, the first increase they've had in fees since when?
Since 1994.
Okay.
And it has been a long time. One of the ways that they have had increases in revenue is that they've had more licenses. Exactly. The revenue increase, the $15 increase, is expected to raise about $461,000 during 2003-05, and this is the fee increase that would be ratified in House Bill 5055 in order for the agency to continue on with the increase. And if there are any questions,
questions are
glad to answer them.
Well, we do have about 7 minutes here. If anybody, you got your hand up first, Ms. Blatt.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just wanted to point out that I'm not sure we've discussed vacancies, and I believe the commission has one vacancy, and I didn't know if you wanted to take some time to talk about that and what the impact would be if that wasn't filled.
That would be very helpful.
Madam Chair, we had an unexpected retirement in December, and our coordinator of teacher licensure, who oversees the public service reps and the evaluators, and the impact of not filling that, I don't exaggerate when I believe it'd be chaos in our office. That person is the advisor that makes sure that the answers that go out are consistent, and that we don't have three public service reps making up their own responses, that she monitors that fairly quickly. And she also oversees the evaluations. She is the, the position is, it has been a woman, the position that also reviews the files that come to the executive director for final approval when there are exceptions or problems with the licensure rule. So it is one of the three professional offices that I was mentioning earlier. The Department of Administrative Services did give us permission to make that executive service, but it is our plan to open the position in March because that's the best time to hire in the academic world. People don't like to announce that they're looking before the end of the academic year, and so we'll hire in the spring, is our hope. We have been given permission to hire back this person on a temporary contract, so we're saving money on the benefits, and the PERS, we're not paying that right now. So that's the one vacancy that we have.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
Comment, Major.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. I just want to appreciate the quality of leadership that is being provided to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission through the chair, Ms. Evenson Brady, and also through the executive director, Vicki Chamberlain. From where I sit, and just reviewing today's discussion and our discussion on yesterday, I would say that it appears that the TSPC is in good and competent hands. I am impressed, have been impressed with the quality of responses to our questions and comments. We've had a really meaty discussion over the last couple of mornings. And I also want to say that what Oregon needs now and requires is aggressive leadership to move our state forward if we are going to better serve those historically underserved populations. And what I've heard from the two of you over the past 2 days gives me some assurances that there's a quality of leadership in place at the TSPC to help us get there. Now what we need to match your efforts and even surpass your efforts are for the professional educational organizations and our schools of education to take on an even greater sense of urgency about this mission and provide a different quality of leadership as well. Frankly, from where I sit, we're still missing an element and capacity of aggressive leadership and understanding of what it is we need to be doing differently. What it is we need to be doing differently. You all grasp it. You've given evidence of that through your testimony. And we have yet to see how and where and if the professional educational organizations and the schools of education are going to be able to match where you're trying to lead them and even surpass where you're trying to lead them. So I thank you very much for your presentation and your commitment. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Senator Gordley. We didn't put a sign-up sheet out for public comment, but if there are any members of the audience back there that wish to come forward and make public comment, this would be an excellent time.
Chair Morgan.
Good morning, Chair Morgan, members of the committee. My name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm with the Oregon Education Association. And I just wanted to come up and just comment quickly and briefly on the fee bill, the proposal. And what I'll say is that we are supportive of the commission's efforts to improve customer service. Our licensees have real needs, and they're trying to address the questions surrounding the new licensure laws and the new continuing education requirements. We also have concerns, though, about raising fees for licenses in a time where we're experiencing drastic salary cuts. The Portland area would be a specific case in point, but there are many school districts across the state that are going through talks this year of having to lop off portions of their salary as we deal with the budget crisis that we're faced with. But we do support the efforts to improve customer service, and we certainly have appreciated all the information that is now online and the improved hours for receiving phone calls from our members. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Questions or comments? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else up there that wishes to come forward? Please come on. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and Committee. I'm Arnie Landsberg from Corvallis, and I'm furthering my education by being a volunteer here at the State House during this session. Previously, I worked for 30 years in chemical engineering research, and then I started volunteering at local schools and found that very rewarding, which it isn't for everybody to mingle with middle school children, but I like it very well. I've taken this time off to see what goes on here. And during my volunteer efforts at the local school, I was encouraged to become a licensed teacher. And I said I didn't want to become full-time, and I didn't want to take a lot of time doing it. I got into the program, and physically it was a lot of work. I appreciate it. I wish there was something for people like myself who can put part-time effort into school systems and help out. And I don't know what it would be, some type of a licensure or just for thoughts for future manning of schools. Also, I see a lot of teachers who would like to work part-time. When I retired, where I worked as a chemical engineer, I was allowed to take half of my retirement pay and half of my regular pay and worked half-time, and I found that very rewarding. One last comment about fingerprints. I'd make a great criminal. I had to go back four times to get fingerprints that registered, and so there is a cost there that was just sort of a sidelight. But and it was done by professional people in the sheriff's office. Have any questions?
Questions or comments? Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Landsberg, did you happen to try to get, like, a substitute license to help to do on a substitute basis?
No. I have a PhD in chemical engineering, so the subject matter is easy for me.
Mm-hmm.
And the just get a license so I could be a teacher and work part-time. That was my thoughts. But I'll be 70 in June, and I think the hours were getting to me.
Further questions or comments? Thank you very much for bringing your experience and your expertise to the building, too. We appreciate that. Anyone else that would like to come forward and testify? No one is coming forward, so I think that will conclude the hearing. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 5054 and House Bill 5055. And please remember that we do not have meetings scheduled in this room with the subcommittee for next week.
Yeah.